This is 1988 Tops, where every card has a story to tell. Your hosts are David McKellis and Matt Kuzma. Let's play ball. Welcome back to 1988 Tops. David, what's our card for this week?
Our card this week is card number 354, Mark Sullivan, catcher for the Boston Red Sox.
But before we get to Mark, we do have some follow-up on last week's episode on Kevin Bass.
I pointed out Kevin Bass's splits against left-handed and right-handed pitchers, and I made a mistake there. Thank you to friend of the show, Mark Simon, for pointing out something that I didn't notice about those starting pitcher splits. In the episode, I said Kevin was critical of himself for his performance from the left side of the plate, but I pointed out that his splits against lefty and righty starting pitchers were basically identical. What Mark Simon pointed out to me is that on Baseball Reference, the way that the starting pitcher splits are calculated takes all of the at-bats in a game into consideration. So it doesn't really tell you only the stats against those starters by handedness. And it includes at-bats against a righty reliever when there was a left-handed starter. And there was a pretty clear difference for Kevin Bass from the left-handed side of the plate versus the right. And he was a bit worse on the left-handed side.
We'll take that into account anytime we have a switch hitter in the future. So thank you, Mark Simon, for sending that. You can always send feedback about the show. Our email address is 1988topspodcast@gmail.com. And now let's go to today's card and Mark Sullivan. And why are we talking about Mark today?
Matt, just look at this card. Take a good look at Mark Sullivan, this ice cream sundae helmet that he's got on, this generic uniform. Mark Sullivan is the son of one of the most controversial figures in Red Sox history. His dad, Haywood Sullivan, was both the owner of the Red Sox and the GM responsible in part for Mark being on the team. Mark Sullivan has a Sabre bio by Armand Patterson, so thank you very much, Armand, for your work here. And this is a guy who I had probably 100 of this card and knew nothing about. And he's also in RBI baseball, a thing I totally forgot.
Well, that makes back-to-back RBI baseball episodes, which is fantastic. We'll hear from Brian in just a moment. And if you had 100 of the card, then just by volume alone, it was inevitable that we would get to Mark Sullivan soon. So let's go to the front of 354. And David, as you mentioned, we have a beautiful-looking card here. We have the shimmering eyes and gorgeous smile of Mark Sullivan. He's got, just like Kevin Bass last week, he has what looks like an extremely generic baseball uniform that should just say baseball on it instead of a team name, like a sack of generic flower with a long sleeve black undershirt, bat held on his shoulder, and a little tiny helmet. And it looks like this photo was taken in parts unknown.
I think this was some kind of blurry field in Florida. You've got a light tower that looks like it's combing his hair.
Just zooming in, though, his eyes are beautiful.
I found this article from 1987 in Sports Illustrated that was meant to talk about whether or not nepotism played any part in Mark's spot on the Boston Red Sox, but it ends up getting a little bit thirsty for Mark. And it says, few ball players look better in a uniform. He is a handsome, solidly developed 6'4", 213 pounder with piercing hazel eyes and stay in place hair. That on this picture, his hair is not in place. It is. He's got some split ends. Spoiler alert. One of his kids was named L'Oreal. It also says, he looks as if he should be running bedroom relays on Days of Our Lives every afternoon.
Oh my goodness. I could definitely see him challenging Stefano for the ladies in Days of Our Lives.
Well, it's a good looking guy. I don't know that I'd go as far as Sports Illustrated would go, but you know, whatever. I don't get paid by the word.
Well, tall, dark, and handsome. Some guys have all the luck. Let's go to the back of 354. We have Mark Sullivan, catcher, 6'4", 213, right-handed batter and thrower. Drafted by the Red Sox in the second round of 1979. Born July 25th, 1958 in Quincy, Massachusetts, with a home in Winter Haven, Florida.
Quincy, Mass, pronounced Quincy, while other cities named Quincy are more pronounced like I just said it, like Quincy, Illinois, Quincy versus Quincy. 101,000 people, up from around 87,000 when Mark was born. Quincy was immediately south of Boston, one of the first suburbs as we know them, just a town built outside of the city. First settled in 1625, birthplace of two presidents, John Adams and John Quincy Adams. Also the first Massachusetts governor and signer of the Declaration of Independence, John Hancock, born there. Historically a manufacturing and shipbuilding center, the city's economy has now moved more to business, insurance, financial institutions, those kind of things. Perhaps more important than Quincy history here is Mark's family history. As referenced before, his dad was an important figure in Red Sox baseball. His dad is Haywood Sullivan, who has his own Sabre bio. So we have now gotten Sabre bio inceptioned, a bio within a bio within a bio. Maybe there'll be a third later on. And his Sabre bio was by Matt Sisson. And Haywood Sullivan was raised in Alabama. He was an outstanding athlete, a quarterback recruited by Alabama and Auburn. But he decided to go to Florida. He chose Florida because it had a more passing-oriented offense. This was the late 40s, totally different game than today's modern football, and Haywood wanted to throw the ball. He also had a friend who already went to school at Florida, and his family didn't have a lot of money. They didn't have their own car, so this friend's family would be able to drive his parents down to go see the games. So that was a real concern for him, was whether or not his family would be able to go to the games, whether or not he would be able to get back and forth from campus without a car. His family was really poor, and so this gave him an opportunity to have his family attend the games, even if they didn't have a lot of money. He ended up becoming the Gators' most prolific passer to that point, setting records that would stand for a decade before Steve Spurrier broke them. He was a big guy too, 6'4", 210 pounds, and could move well for a quarterback. He also played catcher on the Gators baseball team and was named All-SEC in 1952. Nowadays, he would probably accept a spot in the NFL, but at the time, the money was better in baseball. And in fact, the Red Sox offered him a large sum of money. I've seen $75,000 quoted. Also saw $40,000 to $50,000 quoted somewhere. That $75,000 figure is $865,000 in 2023 dollars. That's a lot of money.
That's a shocking signing bonus. We've had plenty of players that had signing bonuses far smaller than that in 1980 or 1979.
Haywood went to the minors, and he was a well-thought-of prospect, then joined the Army, came back, made it to the major leagues, never reached that expected potential, but played parts of seven seasons in the majors for Boston and the Athletics. In 1958, during a season where Haywood didn't play at all due to injury, his son Mark was born in the Boston area. Haywood ends up retiring in 1963. He managed in the minors for the Birmingham Barons, then in Vancouver, then was called up to the Kansas City A's and was the youngest major league manager when he was called in to replace a fired manager.
He managed Kansas City for the rest of the 1965 season. They finished in last place. Bummer. After that season, Haywood Sullivan went back to Boston as director of player personnel under general manager Dick O'Connell. Boston was coming off a 100-loss season, and 2 years later, they won a surprising pennant. Sullivan would later become director of scouting. He became very close friends with Red Sox owners Tom and Gene Yawkey. Tom Yawkey passed away in 1976, and a year later, the team was up for sale. And here's where we have a critical moment in the Sullivan family and Red Sox history.
Sullivan and the former Red Sox trainer, Buddy LaRue, scraped together some money. Sullivan puts his house up as collateral, borrows $100,000, and they put in a bid to Gene Yawkey to buy the Red Sox. Jean didn't have to sell the team. She wasn't being forced to sell the team, so she could accept whatever offer came in, and there was a stipulation that the winner did not have to be the highest bidder. In fact, a higher bidder, including the Rawlings Corporation, was rejected in favor of Sullivan and LaRue. The American League had to approve the sale, and they rejected it. The owners of the other teams voted to reject it, partially because they didn't think that these new owners had enough money to keep the team running if something were to happen. There was also a lawsuit filed by one of the rejected bidders and Ralph Nader suggesting that Red Sox fans would be cheated by this sale. Regardless of the outcome of that lawsuit, the sale was rejected and they were told that they needed to bring in a managing partner, basically somebody with some money. That partner ended up being Gene Yawkey. So it wasn't really a sale. It was more of a shift of property. She donated Fenway Park to this conglomerate, which was valued at $5.5 million. Seems like a steal. And she also donated $1 million in cash. The group brought the bid up to $20.5 million, and the owners approved it. And according to one other owner, they said, what this means now is that Sullivan is the boss. He and Mrs. Yawkey will always vote together. So there were three principal partners. Yawkey, Sullivan would probably vote together regardless. So even if LaRue had a different idea, he could be outvoted. Since LaRue had brought the money men in, that was part of the reason why the previous sale was rejected. The other owners assumed that in a dispute, LaRue would be the controlling interest. They said it's not a knock at LaRue per se. It's just that Sullivan is known and Sullivan is the link to the Yawkey tradition.
So having accomplished this incredible feat in the boardroom, Haywood Sullivan then takes the next step of installing himself as general manager. That year, the Red Sox would win 99 games, but squandered a 14-game division lead and lost the tiebreaker to the Yankees. The next year, 1979, well, let's go back to Mark's story.
Mark had the benefits of being a major league kid's son. He grew up playing catch with Carlton Fisk and Yaz at Fenway. He went to Ted Williams' hitting camp and ran around Red Sox spring training in Florida. And he was a good athlete. He played baseball and basketball at Canton High School in Canton, Mass. Famous Canton High alums, Bill Burr. We love to drop audio clips in. I don't think there's a clip that we can share of Bill Burr that will keep our clean rating. The author of Prince of Thieves, not the Kevin Costner movie, but this is the book that was adapted into the movie The Town, Chuck Hogan. And also Bobby Witt, senior, not junior, all Canton High alums. Mark was the captain of both the baseball and basketball teams. He played infield and was recruited by colleges to play, and he wasn't picked in the draft out of high school, so it wasn't clear that major league scouts were sniffing around Mark Sullivan at this point. He chose to accept a spot on Florida's baseball team, following his dad's footsteps. He had his dad's size, and when he got to Florida, he also got his dad's old position, not as the quarterback. He was moved to catcher. He had been an infielder. But he said, I had to make a decision as to which position would get me the best shot of playing professional ball. I finally chose catching because a lot of guys don't stick with it because of the difficulty of the position. I did pretty well as a catcher, even though I didn't like it.
Yeah, he's not the first to have said that so far on the show, but he made the team as a freshman and played in 9 games. He was the starter as a sophomore in 1978, hitting .207 in 145 at-bats in 45 games. He played in the Cape Cod League over the summers. Didn't have remarkable numbers there either. .270 average with 2 home runs in 1977 and .245 with 4 homers the next year. And then as a junior, he was named first team All-American by the Sporting News and also named All-SEC Eastern Division. But this is with a .244 average with 2 home runs and 18 RBIs. He was also injured and only played 25 games. So how on earth did he become the first-team All-American catcher?
I have no idea. There were 2 competing All-America lists at the time. The Sporting News was picked by the Pro Scouts. 7 of 11 members of the Sporting News team that was picked that year played 5 or more years in the major leagues, compared to only 2 of the coaches' picks. So the Sporting News team turned out better as major league players. It was picked by scouts. But they selected a light-hitting catcher who was a good defensive catcher. I did look at the other selection on the coach's selection, and it was a guy named Herb Arensky, who in his Delaware career hit .310 with a school record 33 home runs, 135 RBIs. But Arensky wasn't drafted. He signed as a free agent, making it as high as AAA in the Phillies system. So he never made it to the pros either, but he had a what looks like a better college record. So for whatever reason, I don't know if Haywood Sullivan had any sway here on the scouts who were picking this Sporting News team, or if maybe the Sporting News just wanted to get in close with the new owner of the Red Sox. But it's just a very odd selection.
Yeah, or maybe SEC bias as we see other places. But regardless, after that junior year, Mark and his dad discussed the draft and whether he should go pro. And Mark said, "We went over everything, that I would stay in school if I weren't drafted in the first three rounds." And that takes us to the This Week of the Clubhouse that Mark signed as a second-round draft selection with the Boston Red Sox, June 7th, 1979, by scout George Digby.
George Digby is the guy who signed Mike Greenwell, Mike Smithson, Jody Reed, Wade Boggs. We discussed him in the Reed Nichols episode, a Red Sox Hall of Famer who passed away in 2014 at the age of 96. That conversation that Mark had with his dad, who at this point was the owner and GM of the Red Sox, they discussed the possibilities of being drafted by Boston. Mark said, "I knew there would be bad or negative aspects, but no matter where I went or whom I played for, I'd always hear stuff about my dad. If I couldn't take that, then how could I take the hard part of the game?" Haywood claimed, "I had nothing to do with the drafting, evaluating, or selecting. That was done by farm director Eddie Kenny and scouting director Eddie Casco, but I'll still be the one who gets knocked for it." So looking at that draft, the first round, you have Andy Van Slyke, Tim Wallach, Steve Buschel, Atlee Hammaker. The Red Sox didn't have a first-round pick that year, so Mark Sullivan is their first pick in the draft. There were a few catchers selected before Mark, none who really did much of anything in the majors, most notably Bob Guerin, who played for the Yankees and managed the A's for a few years. But it's not like there was another guy who you look at and say, that's who they should have selected. There were some better players picked later in the draft, guys like Bill Doran, Harold Reynolds in the sixth round. Dan Marino was picked in the fourth round. They could have gotten a good quarterback. Oral Hershiser in the 17th, Don Mattingly in the 18th. You can't really blame the Red Sox for passing up those guys who were picked so much later. This is just a really weird selection. The farm director said, "He's a kid who looks like he can throw and hit. First-class catchers are hard to find." It's just really odd that this was the first selection, the second round, 52nd overall pick. Did they really think they would lose him to another team? If they did lose him to another team, he could just pass on signing with that team. He had another senior season that he could play. I just don't get it.
Yeah, it doesn't make sense. Mark later said no one in his right mind would believe they'd waste a high draft pick on the father-son thing, but it's something I'll have to get used to and play my way out of. A real hardship to be picked second by your dad. Regardless, Mark went to A-ball at Winter Haven the first year. He hit 207, but played solid defense. Peter Gammons reported that if you ask minor league pitchers, they'll tell you he is far and away the best defensive catcher, receiving and throwing the ball. Well, that's good. That's actually a pretty good source of praise. He stayed at Winter Haven another year, hitting 225 in 1980. Meanwhile, his dad was making some questionable decisions as general manager.
In 1977, Sullivan had said, "I don't think you can trade a Fisk, a Jimmy Rice, a Fred Lynn, a Carl Yastrzemski, or a Rick Burleson. When you trade key men like that, you're just defeating your own purpose." In late 1980, Haywood Sullivan, the GM, traded Rick Burleson and Fred Lynn to the California Angels, and then he lost Carlton Fisk to free agency when the team didn't mail Fisk his contract in time.
Whoops.
Yeah, that's a big whoops. They did get Carney Lansford back for Burleson. The Red Sox finished over 500, but didn't make the playoffs in the strike-shortened 1981 season. Mark was still at Winston-Salem, still in A-ball, and actually played well. Hit 269, 14 home runs, 21 doubles, had an OPS of 807. And this is one of the only stat lines in his career that says future major league player. And he did get a fun fact out of it.
Yeah, that's right. The fun fact is that Mark led Carolina League catchers with 902 chances accepted and a .984 percentage at Winston-Salem in 1981.
A good defensive catcher. He's doing the job behind the plate. With those offensive numbers, he's getting compared to Carlton Fisk, which is probably not helpful when your dad just let him go and There's very few guys who can live up to that potential, but it seemed like a good sign that things were getting better. Earlier in the season, he had been refusing interviews about anything other than his and the team's performances. Reporters wanted to ask him about his dad and the Red Sox, and he said, "Who am I to do that? I'm a catcher and A-ball."
Yeah, but not for long. He moved up to Double-A Bristol in 1982. He hit only .203 with one home run, continued to be defensively solid despite that offensive dip, and was called up briefly to Pawtucket. And then Rich Gedman broke his collarbone, and Boston needed a catcher, despite there being another catcher on the team, John Lickert or Likert, not sure which one. But Sullivan was called up to the majors despite playing four games at Triple-A.
So, Matt, I don't know how to pronounce this guy's name either, because he never ended up making it to the major leagues. He does have a Sabre bio. So, again, thank you to Sabre. I should take that back. He played one game in the major leagues. John Likert? I don't think he was that bad. In looking at his numbers, he hit .250 that year in 115 games at Triple-A. His defensive stats weren't remarkably bad, but he had been sitting out getting ready for winter ball. So at the time, Sullivan had just gotten called up from Double-A, was playing at Triple-A. He was deemed more ready to go to the majors. He gets called up on September 18th. Sorry, John. Stay in Triple-A. Go play winter ball. Instead, Mark Sullivan makes his debut on October 1st at Yankee Stadium.
In his first at-bat, he got an infield hit off Louisiana Lightning Ron Guidry. Later in the game, he threw out a base runner, so that's an incredibly successful debut. He played one more game and got another hit, ending the season 2-for-6. Manager Ralph Hoke compared his arm to Lance Parrish. My goodness. But somehow in 1983, that didn't translate into a roster spot, so on the back of the card, there's no line for 1983. The Red Sox picked up Jeff Newman as a third catcher behind Gedman and Gary Allenson. Mark Sullivan was back at Double-A New Britain, hitting .229 with seven homers, played a little bit at first base as well, called up to Triple-A for a bit, hit .186, and then in August, a foul tip hit his fibula, ending his season.
His dad also ran into an ownership fight this year. Before a scheduled owners meeting and on a day that was meant to honor the sick Tony Conigliaro, Buddy LaRue informed his co-owners, Sullivan and John Harrington, who was Gene Yawkey's representative, that he was taking control of the team. He claimed that he controlled 16 of the 30 limited partnership shares, and he drafted an amendment to the partnership agreement, making himself managing general partner. Then he fired Sullivan, brought back Dick O'Connell to be GM. The parties went to court, and it was determined that the limited partners didn't actually have the authority to overrule the managing partners on baseball issues. So LaRue was one of three managing partners, and he was outvoted by Sullivan and Yawkey. It just was an ugly scene. You have this management fight, you have limited partners voting to remove the other two managing partners. It was pretty bad, but it ended up back as they started. Sullivan and Yawkey are still in control of the team. Sullivan is still the GM, but there's clearly trouble brewing.
In 1984, Mark Sullivan was back at Pawtucket, hitting .204 with 15 homers, and then was a September call-up to the majors, appearing in two games, going 3-for-6 in those games, had a .417 average in four games so far in the major leagues. Rich Gedman had solidified his starting spot in 1984, hitting .269 with 24 homers. So Sullivan definitely looks to be blocked here. And then in 1984, Haywood Sullivan finally stepped down as general manager. Well, actually stepped up to be CEO. He was replaced by Lou Gorman, who is credited with building the 1986 team. But taking a look back at the Haywood Sullivan era as general manager, he was blamed for losing those big names from the 70s, and fans made stickers that said, "Haywood and Buddy are killing the Sox." Bad Sox management. Is that anything you're familiar with, David?
No idea. Nothing to add to this. You know, ownership, just everything's fine. It's totally fine.
Well, 1985, John McNamara was the Red Sox manager, and Mark Sullivan made the team as one of three catchers. He was getting credit for his play, hitting 280 in spring training. And reporters said Mark made the squad on merit, not because he is the boss's son. He started 23 games that year, hitting 174 with two homers. That's an OPS plus of 42 and a couple trips to the DL. Not really a great season or a great line on this card in 1985.
Meanwhile, Rich Gedman is an all-star, so Sullivan's not really pushing him for that starting spot. He did work with Carl Yastrzemski on his swing in spring training the next year. Through May 30th of 1986, he is hitting 306 in 12 games. Then through the rest of the season, he played in only 29 more games and hit 145. During that stretch, the fans, of course, they were very patient with the boss's slash owner's slash GM's son. They were booing him. His average would have been even worse, but in his last four games, he went 5-for-15 to bring it up to 193 on the year. He was named to the postseason roster, but he didn't make an appearance in the ALCS or the World Series.
So with that 193 average below the Mendoza line, you wouldn't expect him to make any kind of memorialized roster of that 1986 team. However, because the Red Sox made the 1986 playoffs, they were in RBI baseball. And for reasons unknown, Mark Sullivan was included. Let's find out why in the RBI corner. And we are back-to-back weeks in the RBI corner. Brian, welcome back to the show. We are here to talk about the Boston Red Sox and Mark Sullivan.
So excited to be back. We talked about the Boston Red Sox most recently in the Don Baylor episode. And of course, it's back-to-back because we just talked about Kevin Bass in the show. And I think one way to think about Boston in RBI baseball is they're kind of the opposite of Houston. Houston has decent pitching and speed, but just no power whatsoever. Boston, on the other hand, has average pitching, but they have tremendous power. They're very right-handed. They have a lot of substitutions on their bench, but they can score runs in bunches with players like Jim Rice, Don Baylor, Dwight Evans, Rich Gedman, Wade Boggs, Tony Armas, Ellis Burks, Dave Henderson, just a star-studded lineup with a ton of power. Now, if you've played RBI baseball, you've probably used Boston a fair amount, as they're a very good team, they're a very famous team, and a very popular team. So you're probably familiar with all of these Red Sox, and you're probably also familiar with Mark Sullivan, who's that guy with the pitcher's stats on the end of the bench who you might be afraid to sub in. So happy to talk about Mark Sullivan today.
Fantastic. And Brian, when we asked you to come on to the show to talk about Mark Sullivan, your response was that he was famous in RBI baseball circles and that this would be a hotly anticipated RBI corner. So what gives?
Well, he has the worst stats of any position player in the game, and by a fair amount. I don't believe there's any other position player that has a batting average below 200 other than the pitcher. So the pitcher in RBI baseball has standard stats of 150 and no home runs. Mark Sullivan has his actual 1986 stats in the game, which is a batting average of 193 with one home run. And he actually does kind of hit like the pitcher. So he's very unusual because other RBI baseball players usually at least have some attributes that are pretty good. And we'll get to what Mark Sullivan's are in a little bit. But it's kind of like having a pitcher up at the plate when you bat with Mark Sullivan.
It's shockingly poor statistics.
Yeah, so I guess the one good thing about him is his name is shortened to Sullivn. So that's kind of fun to say in RBI baseball when he comes up. You can only have six characters, this being Nintendo in 1988 or 1989. So you just get this Sullivn when he comes up to the plate. But, you know, he's tied with Tony Armas as the game's slowest player. The pitchers are also slow in RBI baseball, so he's got that going for him. And of course, Armas is one of the game's best power hitters. And he's also tied for having the worst contact rating in the game with Jim Lindemann. And when you bat with him, his contact is often very weak. So it's like you're batting with the pitcher where the ball just comes off the bat really slowly and the player himself is so slow running to first base. According to the Dini website's ranking of all 120 RBI baseball position players, he actually ranks 117 out of 120, just behind Al Pedrique and ahead of only Wally Backman, Spike Owen, and Rafael Santana, all of these late-hitting middle infield type. But I will say this about Mark Sullivan. He's a bizarrely successful source of unexpected power, and he's a real cult hero in RBI baseball. Now, there's a lot of cult heroes in this game, and sometimes these are merely apocryphal. You know, you had somebody who had great success in one moment with this one player and assumes this person has a clutch gene. But Sullivan really does come up with unexpected big home runs, and part of that is that they're so unexpected, given that he's among the game's worst hitters. But I'm going to stake my RBI baseball reputation on this. It really does happen with Mark Sullivan. He doesn't always do it, but he'll often come up to the plate and hit totally unexpected shock pinch hit home runs, and usually ones that come off the bat very slowly and just barely make it over the fence. And this is actually backed up by the game's programming for two reasons. Number one is that players do have a bonus when they come up in pinch hitting situations when they're taken off the bench. With their first at bat, they have a little more power than they would otherwise. And the second is that Mark Sullivan actually has okay power in the game. It's the same level of power as Wade Boggs, Willie McGee, and Benito Santiago. Those are notable players, all-star type players. So Mark Sullivan absolutely can hit home runs.
So would you ever consider a situation of starting Mark Sullivan? And if not, like, when do you bring him in?
You would absolutely not consider starting him. Boston has an incredible bench, and three of these guys would probably be the best hitter on teams like Houston or St. Louis. But Mark Sullivan is the fourth guy. He's not one of those top three guys. So you never, ever start Mark Sullivan. But what you do want to do is save him for a random moment where you need to swap the pitcher out and you need to hit an improbable home run. And because Mark Sullivan is such a weak hitter, you'll feel that much more accomplished when you have success with Mark Sullivan in RBI baseball.
Brian, when I was looking at Mark Sullivan, the player, I had no thought that you were going to be on the show this week because his stats are terrible. And this is the 1986 Red Sox. This is a World Series team. Why in the world would Mark Sullivan be on this team? Mike Greenwell wasn't on this team, and he's actually a star player at the time that the game is coming out. Does it make any sense for Mark Sullivan to be on this team? Are there other teams with multiple backup catchers, or why is he here?
That's a great question. There are a few teams that do have their backup catchers as bench players. I believe Detroit with Mike Heath comes to mind, and the Cardinals with Steve Lake. But most teams don't. And of course, RBI baseball is basically positionless. So when you bring a player in off the bench, if you swap them in for a regular player, they don't have any sort of positional designation. So there's no need to have Mark Sullivan. I looked into this a little bit, and part of the explanation, there's a couple of ideas. One is that he actually did have a fair number of plate appearances in 1986. Whether that was wise or not is maybe a separate question, but he was certainly in the lineup a fair amount across the course of the season. A second reason might be because the Red Sox traded some of their bench players across the course of the year, and maybe they didn't want to include players like Steve Lyons, who were traded during the 1986 season, were not part of the team by the end of the year, even if they ultimately had more plate appearances than Mark Sullivan and were certainly a better hitter than Mark Sullivan. So I guess that all adds up to it. A third theory might be that it's just for balance. Boston's three bench hitters are absolutely incredible. So maybe you include Mark Sullivan in the game because it's a bit of a counterweight against guys like Tony Armas, who come up with some of the best power in the game. And on the other hand, you've got Mark Sullivan, who maybe has a little bit of power, but is one of the worst hitters.
Well, you just gave a thoughtful and well-researched answer. I was just going to suggest that maybe his dad worked for the game publisher.
Sometimes the simplest and most direct explanations are the best. So let's go with that one.
Great. Well, Brian, like Mark Sullivan, we consider you one of the real cult heroes of RBI baseball. So thanks again for joining us.
Wonderful to be here, guys. Take care.
In 1987, Rich Gedman had not signed a contract. That opened the door for Mark Sullivan. Sullivan got a $40,000 raise to $125,000 a year. Pretty good.
And he did that without an agent.
No, what? There was no agent taking 10%?
No agent. There are little things about this story that make it hard for me to make any other conclusion than he got special treatment because his dad owned the team. And I tried every way I could to figure out, like, well, yeah, I'll give him benefit of the doubt here. But this one, he didn't have an agent. And he's signing a contract that gives him a 50% pay increase from his $85,000 a year salary the prior year. He is presumed to be the starter by default. And this is also Rich Gedman not signing a contract. There's owner collusion at the time. So you have that keeping Gedman out of the lineup. Boston Globe writer Dan Shaughnessy said, Sullivan knows a large percentage of the public believes the Red Sox failed to sign Gedman to make room for Sonny. The Red Sox also had Danny Schaefer, who had hit 340 at AAA the year prior, and he was also on the team. So Sullivan ends up starting opening day. He got hits in his first three games, but by the end of April, he's right back where we expect him to be, actually worse than the year before, hitting 163. Rich Gedman did sign that contract. He's back by May 2nd. He started slow and then got hurt, but it didn't get any better for Mark, who continued to struggle. Boston Globe said, the longer Sullivan plays, the more it appears he is on the team because his father wants Mark and his young family to enjoy the good life in the majors rather than the bad life in the minors. The fans, again, they're fed up. They see this guy on the field. Mark had held back before, but when he got booed now, he was frustrated. He pointed out that the fans had also abused Jim Eisenreich when he was suffering from Tourette's. And he said, that shows the kind of fans we've got here. They don't give a damn. That's all I've got to say. I try the best I can.
That's going to work out well, criticizing the fans. That always works out to the benefit of,
no,
of the player.
It is the children who are wrong.
The Red Sox split time between Sullivan, Schaefer, who was bad and got sent down. Also rookie John Marzano, who was called up in late July. Marzano got the majority of the starts from his call-up. And Sullivan at that point was really just an afterthought, making only 11 appearances between August and October. So for the year 1987, in the last line of this card, Mark Sullivan had a 169 average with two home runs, a slash line of 169, 198, 238. That is an OPS plus of 14 in 160 at-bats.
I did a StatHead search. Since 1900, players with 150 or more plate appearances looking for the lowest OPS plus, Mark's is the 42nd lowest.
Ooh.
The worst is minus 11 from Frank O'Rourke in 1912 for the Boston Braves. Also a guy named Togi Pittenger had a minus 6. Togi.
It's pretty bad.
Pretty bad. But 14, also pretty bad.
He was still a good defensive catcher, throwing out 40% of base stealers, which was good for third in the American League. And while he was overall a negative war player, he had a positive defensive war. After the 1987 season, Sullivan said he was trying to pick up pitching, throwing with the Red Sox pitching coach. Why not? That experiment never really came to anything, but Lou Gorman did try to trade Sullivan. His dad didn't interfere in the slightest, but it was delicate trading a young man who happens to be the son of my boss. Gorman sent Sullivan to Houston for Randy Randall, an infielder who never made it above AA. Sullivan dealt with an injury at AAA in 1988, signing with Philadelphia, playing at AAA, and then finally did the same with the White Sox. He was never called up. He had a couple close calls, but injuries didn't allow him to make the big leagues again. He signed as a catching instructor with Cleveland after that, then ended up in 12 games for Colorado Springs, their AAA affiliate. And after that, he retired as a player. So closing the book on Mark Sullivan, 5 seasons in the major leagues, 137 games he played in, batting average of 186 with 5 home runs, 11 doubles, 28 RBIs, an OPS plus of 33, one of only 22 position players with more than 350 plate appearances, and an OPS plus under 35. Epically poor at the plate. But we checked the stats. Who did he love to face?
I put a question mark after this love to face in my notes here because there was only one pitcher who he hit over 300 against with 10 or more plate appearances. That was Floyd Bannister. He went 3-for-8 with a walk and a sacrifice bunt. I guess you could say he loved to face Mark Langston. Of his 5 career home runs, 2 of them came off of Mark Langston. And hated to face was, I guess, every other pitcher in the major leagues.
How about in retirement?
Mark and his wife, Angela, who had been a swimsuit model. She won the swimsuit competition in the 1981 Miss Florida pageant. She ran a modeling agency, and she used Mark in ads for that modeling agency. It was called Models World Studio in Lakeland, Florida. So Mark and his wife had 4 children, L'Oreal, Brandon, Sierra, and Crystal. Mark initially was a scout for the Rangers for a few years. His name came up as a possible coaching candidate. He ended up let go in 1994. His dad, Haywood Sullivan, eventually sold his stake in the Red Sox in 1993, turning that initial $100,000 investment into a $33 million buyout. That's a pretty good return on investment over less than 20 years. Mark and his dad went into real estate in Fort Myers. They used that buyout money to purchase and develop a hotel, marina, and a realty company. Haywood passed away in 2003 at the age of 72, and Mark continued to manage the properties from his dad's estate. I found an article that in early 2022, those waterfront properties were sold for redevelopment for $20 million. Mark himself has probably made a good profit off of that work from that generational wealth that was created from his dad's investment in the Red Sox.
Well, David, this is the episode where we've dug the most into someone's family. We started with just a card of a good-looking guy, but now after looking so much into Mark and Haywood Sullivan's story, what do we think?
You know, listeners, apologies that we Tarantino'd this one and we jumped all over, messed with the timeline. Haywood Sullivan was in many ways a self-made millionaire. Part of that was due to his friendship with the Yawkey family, but that was part of his own doing. He became friends with them. He became a trusted confidant. They were willing to loan him Fenway Park to purchase the team, and they trusted him to run the team. It didn't really work out, but Haywood Sullivan had an interesting story. He said, "I came from nothing. I was a player in an era where you didn't ever go up to the front office. I moved along as a coach and a manager, but never in my wildest dreams did I feel I would be involved in ownership." And maybe he didn't believe that he would ever reach that height, and maybe some Red Sox fans would wish that he hadn't. And he became one of the most controversial figures in Red Sox history, destroying a potentially great team in the late 1970s. He became an owner at a time when the Red Sox were bad and they didn't spend money on free agents and they drafted terribly. And he was part of that as the GM, making many of those decisions. As the GM, one of the things to point to as a bad decision is the second round selection and the apparent nepotism drafting Mark Sullivan, and then his time playing with the Red Sox as a guy hitting 160, 190, just showing nothing. And by the time 1987 comes around, you have a 28-year-old catcher who has never shown that he will be a starting catcher, and yet there he is on opening day. Mark was unable to ever perform well enough to overcome what was pretty clearly nepotism. That said, while he did get angry late in his career at the fans for booing him, he's come back around and he is part of fantasy camps and got over that difficult time in Boston and returned to Fenway as part of the ceremony in 2006, celebrating the 20th anniversary of that 1986 team. But when you're looking at Mark Sullivan, it's not just that he's bad, it's that he was also keeping other players from getting their shot. And you have guys like John Leichhardt, who played in the Red Sox system for years, hit 294 in 1984 at AAA, and by the numbers I can see on defense, he looks okay. Two errors in 48 games that year, and he didn't get called up. And I don't blame Mark Sullivan for this. I blame management that either kept him in the lineup, kept him on the team, or was afraid to get rid of him for fear of retribution from the owner. Mark himself said, "In Boston, I can be blamed for almost anything. If it's a wild pitch, I take the heat because my father signed the pitcher. I took heat in 1981 when Fisk left and I was in Class A ball. Heck, I took heat when the Patriots lost the Super Bowl because their owner's name was Sullivan too." And Sullivan also got the other side of that, which was guys assuming that he had sway with his dad because he was on the team. He said, "If someone's having a contract dispute, then guys will say to me, just have your father take it out of your allowance." Like I said, I don't blame Mark Sullivan for being on the team. What's he going to do? Say, I'd rather not trade me to some other team? That looks like quitting. Instead, he wanted to show that he belonged and show that he deserved that spot. Just he was never good enough or able to do that or given enough consistent playing time because he didn't show anything to deserve that consistent playing time.
We've seen people start slow in their career. We've seen players who were late bloomers, and it's not until 25 or 26 that they really take off. We've seen people be great in college and flame out. The path toward greatness, we've seen lots of different examples there. And baseball is such a fickle sport that it's hard to know sometimes what you're going to get. In 1979, the Red Sox made 22 picks, but sometimes the draft, there's 50 or 60 rounds, and the number of players who end up making it is extremely small. So we know that sometimes what someone looks like on paper doesn't tell the future of what they're going to be. And we've also seen examples through these episodes of players who had the intangibles, who were the coach's son or had a lucky break and it ends up paying off. So you can understand in some way that if someone loves baseball and they end up becoming the general manager or the owner of the team, that they think maybe my kid will do great at it. And he's done okay so far, but maybe he just needs a break and it will turn out well. Like you said, you can't blame Mark Sullivan for him getting chances. He's a pro athlete. Pro athletes have confidence in themselves, and they think that if they get the chance, they'll be able to do it. And all they want is the opportunity. But what does stand out from this story is how many times someone was given a chance and doesn't perform and then crowds out the opportunities for other people, and the team ends up suffering overall. So it's kind of an unfortunate story for Mark to get lots of blame placed on him and taking some abuse for that. But oh well, we'll just have to deal with the life of being married to a swimsuit model and managing an 8-figure real estate portfolio. I guess them's the breaks. A great story of the family, so thank you, David, for that. And thank you to you at home. If you also are a bizarrely successful source of unexpected power, we'd love to hear about it on Twitter. We're at Topps 1988. Thanks a lot, and we'll see you next week.